My name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland.
Every great war story always seems to be told by a veteran who starts with the words, "So there I was." And I'm going to tell you folks that this is the part three, the final part of this story. And it is, it's not difficult. It may not seem difficult to tell it. It will perhaps be somewhat difficult for those of you who know exactly what I'm talking about. I've tried to, the reason why I did this in three parts was so that you would understand who it was I was talking about when I make references here in the next course of time here as we discuss what really went down. We ended up with our move to Thousand Oaks, and I was there doing afternoons with Dennis and with a fine show and a very funny guy. And we had been going for about 3 years. The benchmark that I have for this, which is really kind of odd, the Craig Ferguson Late Late Show on CBS launched on the exact same date that we did, which was on my birthday, actually. And we had a kind of a fun time with that, and the show was tremendous. Dennis was a very good writer, still is. He lives actually about a block from here, from where I live, and I still see him from time to time. He misses the industry. He is now making movies. He's out, you know, doing various bits of television and pursuing his dreams as a writer and as an actor, and that's awesome. So there I was driving into work one morning, and when my phone rang as I was pulling into the parking lot at 2650 Thousand Oaks, and it was Tim Spencer. And I thought, oh God, now what? And I answered it, and he said, where are you? And I said, I'm down in the parking lot. And he says, well, when you get here, I need you to come upstairs. Come up to my office. I said, okay. And he was being rather stern and forceful, as he usually is. And keep in mind, to give you an idea of what it was like working with Tim, when we had moved to Thousand Oaks, we were working with relatively antiquated production equipment. And I had been told by Tim Davies at the time that we would be getting these fantastic programmable Wheatstone boards, these consoles that would that were very, very technical. They were wonders to work with. They were just beautiful all the way around. And the move had cost them so much money that they had skimped, and I was actually working with very, very old equipment. In fact, we went kind of back in time technology-wise, somehow tapping computers into all of this bullshit and made it work, and that's what we did. And during the transition phase, when we have a new – my office was a production studio, and I'm in there trying to tweak it and make it work, because when you work with equipment like this, as you, those of you who are engineers understand this, there's a lot of fine-tuning that goes into this. And – well, things weren't going so well, and that room just really sounded bad. And Tim Spencer came into that studio one day, and we had these big, huge soundproof doors. They were very thick. They were about 3 or 4 inches thick. They were solid doors, had a little window in them, but they were soundproof. And it took a little bit of, they had a magnetic seal on them, and you had to kind of punch them a little bit to get them open. And when they did, you could feel the pressure of the room change, because the air would just get sucked out. Of course, Tim had that ability to suck the life out of every bit of room, no matter what it was. And he came in, and I could tell immediately by the look on his face and his body language that he was pissed at me. And he commenced to yell and screaming at me about how bad the room sounded, and wanted to know why I wasn't able to do anything with it. And I jumped up out of my chair. And now look, I'm a pacifist, right? I'm not violent by any means whatsoever, and that was certainly never going to cross my mind. And I jumped up out of that chair, and I put my index fingers dead square in his sternum. And I said, first of all, you don't come in here with this bullshit attitude about something that is outside of my control. Second of all, your boss had promised us equipment that was going to be worth a shit. Instead, we're dealing with stuff that Marconi used, for God's sake. It was garbage. You skimped on it, everything else, and now you're putting it back onto my shoulders as if it was my fault. Get a goddamn engineer in here that knows how to tighten this room up and make it happen. The basic problem, and you're going to laugh at this, we were unable to do anything in that room in stereo. Something as simple as stereo. It was split-channel mono. It was ridiculous. I was producing stuff at home to take. I was doing homework. I was doing my production at home to take to the station to get onto the radio to make it sound good. Because if my voice was on something, by God, it was going to be right. If it was the one thing that I did, and I pride myself in my broadcasting career, is I was a bit of a perfectionist. And I made sure Tim was fully aware of that. He backed down. He apologized. That was that. So there I was in the parking lot, and I pull into my parking space, and I see Dennis out there, and he's leaning up against his the hood of his car, and he's got his head down, and he's looking at his feet, and I get out and say, hey, what's up, man? And he was weeping, and he said that they canceled our show. The Dennis and Rick show was no longer on the air because they had just fired Dennis. And at that second, I thought, well, I had just taken a phone call from Tim Spencer and he's winding me up in his office. So I'm thinking, well, shit, I might as well just leave my stuff here in the car because this may be a really short trip up there. And he told me that they were making some changes and that he was the odd man out. That phrase, odd man out, will come back into this episode here in a moment. So I went upstairs after consoling Dennis the best I could. Oddly enough, Tim's office overlooked the parking lot, so I know he saw me talking to Dennis at that time. And I went upstairs, and Tim is sitting there, and he had a kind of a small office, and he had these two chairs that were impossibly close to each other, and then there was his desk, and then where his chair was. And I walk in there, I went, yeah, what's going on? And he said, close the door. And when he says close the door, then you know some shit's going to happen. Of course, I've already got a little inside information, which I'm sure he knew about, that I knew that Dennis was gone and our show was canceled. And he says for me to sit down. And I, of course, I did. And I at the time, I carried kind of a backpack type thing. I had over one of my shoulders, and I never took it off, now that I think about it. And around my neck was a lanyard that had a key card on it. And I just instinctively reached for it, and I went to go to take the thing off because I knew this was it. And Tim looked at me and he said, relax, let go of the key card, take your bag off, sit down, shut up, and listen to me. He tells me that he has fired Dennis because he needed to move me out of afternoons and into morning drive. It was the plum gig, really. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. He was putting me into morning drive radio. I guess the 3 years that Dennis and I were, 3+ years that Dennis and I were on in the afternoons, we did such a fine job that corporate thought it was a good idea to advance my career. Now, Tim, of course, prefaces all of this with, this was my decision. This wasn't anybody else's decision, but I'm no longer going to be on the air in the morning. So you and John are going to be working together. You and Bad Dog are going to do the show together. And I'm bringing Lutza up as the producer from the afternoon show. And she's going to produce you guys, and we're going to give this a shot and see how this works out. And he says, right now, we need to go down to Tim Davies' office and have a chat where John is right now. Bad Dog is already down in that office, and he's being told exactly what I've been told. And now Davies wants to chat with all of us. Now, if you recall last week, I mentioned that I had been in Davies' office with his feet up on his desk and the pile of key cards up on his on the corner of his desk along by his feet. That arrogant bastard fought like that. It was sort of a show of force. His office was kind of a weird triangular-shaped room. Down the left side as you walked into it was a small couch. There was a couple of bookshelves there and this kind of an L-shaped desk. And then he had a corner office part of it where the windows overlooked into the fountain area where they had these ducks that would sit in the pond a lot. And there were geese that came through there. And it was a kind of an idyllic setting. I guess if you're running a cluster of stations, you need to take a moment to look out the window and contemplate how bad you're going to fuck somebody over. Because that was a feeling that I got when I walked into the room. I thought, this is okay. There's something okay about me doing the morning drive thing. But at the same time, it just seems like I'm about to make some sort of deal with the devil. And it turned out to be sort of the case because, as the old saying goes, the devil's in the details. So there's John. He's sitting there in one of the chairs, and Tim walks in. Spencer walks in. He sits on the couch, and he's got a clipboard, a notepad of some sort, and he's being quiet, and he's listening. As I come in, and Davies doesn't even get out of his chair to shake my hand or anything. He just says, "Have a seat." I sit down, and he says, "As you can tell by the pile of keys on my desk, we've gone through another reduction in force, and I can assure you that no more people are going to be let go today." And I could feel the color just draining out of my skin. He says, he proceeds to tell me and John that Clear Channel Corporate, which was based in San Antonio, Texas at the time, was in deep conversations with their regional office in Memphis about what they were going to do and how they were going to take care of their ratings problem for Morning Drive. What it equated to in my mind was that Tim Spencer had shot a hole in his own show, and it was time for him to get off the air and just stay on as management, which is what he did. Ultimately, he wound up picking up afternoons as a voice track jock, just cold, short jock, and that was the Rolling Stones, here's Led Zeppelin, you know, that kind of thing. And that's kind of what he did. Here's a traffic report. All of it was all canned. It was all, none of it was live. There was no spontaneity to it. It was just bullshit radio. Meanwhile, Davies proceeds to tell John and I that they had looked at every option as to what they were going to do in Morning Drive, including the fact that they were going to bring in a syndicated show, but they had opted against that to give me and John a shot at it. The name of the show was already set in stone. It was going to happen. It was to be the Bad Dog and Rick in the Morning Show. And John, much to my dismay and his wild, boisterous sense of humor, says, "Well, I think you probably should have gone with your syndicated show." And he looks at me and he goes, "Because I don't think I can work with this fucker." And then, of course, proceeds to laugh out loud in that boisterous laugh that John was so famous for. Now, this needs to be understood. My contract at that time when I was doing Morning Drive had expired. And my contract called for a fairly decent salary. It had there were some bonuses that were built in there for ratings, none of which I ever really saw, to be quite frank with you, because I always found a way to not have to write a check. And I asked since I'm doing this, you're asking me to get into, in essence, a lifestyle change. I mean, when you do Morning Drive radio, you're on the air at 6 o'clock and you got to have your shit together at 6 o'clock, which means you got to get up at 4. You got to start your show prep by 4:30. You learn to do things like take a shower before you go to bed. You have an automatic coffee pot that has your coffee brewing all ready for you when you get up. You can have a cup of coffee. You get dressed. You spend a few minutes, you know, taking a look at what all's happening in the world, kind of get an idea of what direction your show is going to go in. And then you get in the car and you drive that 20 minutes to work. And you get in there. You get your final shit put together. You print off what needs to be printed off. You sit down. And next thing you know, if you're lucky, it's about 10 minutes to 6. You got a second to enjoy your coffee. And then away you go. And that is a lifestyle change. And it to this day, it has actually kind of fucked me up. I'm a night person. I'm naturally a night person. I often usually don't go to bed till 3:30 anyway. So having to get up at 4 o'clock really kind of turned things around. So I thought, well, you know, maybe look, John's been on the air for 25 years. He's making some big money. And he was very well paid. I was making about half of what he was making at the time. And I thought, well, this would be at least a chance for me to, you know, see some of the fruits of my labors. And I was told, no, that I was lucky that I had a job and that there was no increase at all. However, they would make up for that in what was called talent fees, and that I would get to do a lot of live reads of various sponsors, and they would pay for that. And, it, you know, they didn't lie to me about that, but that's consider that the last, you know, bit of truth they gave me. So it we took the rest of the day off, and that was that. I went home. Wrapped my head around all of this, and I think I want to say that was on a Friday. By Monday, John and I would launch the brand new show. And Monday morning, I didn't sleep Sunday night. I was just terrified of the whole thing because, you know, first of all, working with the great John McCormack was a dream in and of itself. Dealing with the pressures of that were going to be pretty tough. Not that I'm being a wuss about it. It was very difficult because I understood his sense of humor, and he was lightning fast. But he had languished working under Tim, and the show had suffered as a result of it. And I came in and I gave new blood to that show, and it took off and it did well. We had a bit of a rough start. One of those rough starts, unfortunately, came from the hand of our producer. Now, Lutza meant so well, tried to do the right things. She tried to participate. She tried to be what Bev Hart was. And I kept getting orders from, not, this is how big of a dick Tim Spencer was, is that he would send me text messages while I was on the air telling me to shut her up. And of course, I didn't do it. I thought what she was adding to the program was okay. Maybe she'll hear this and she'll understand that I'm not the culprit here. Ultimately, long story short, she was fired. She was run out and she hated me ever since. In fact, at John's funeral, she was there and I was standing probably 6 feet from her. She didn't know it. I didn't really realize it until I turned around and she saw me and she immediately turned her face and walked away. I never really got the chance to talk to her and certainly not at a colleague's funeral. That you just don't do that. Last I heard, she's, of course, still out of the business. She married a former salesman by the name of Steven. They have a couple of kids now, and they're doing really well, and I wish them all the best. But that's when Brother Doug came to us. Brother Doug came on to produce that morning show and did a stellar job. He was already doing some weekends and some other fill-in work, and this was a chance for him to go full-time and really take it, and he did a great job. And with his guidance and through John's expertise and my wit, we were able to, you know, lash together a pretty good show. And it went well. Went well for about a year. And then one morning, and there's a lot that leads up to this, but as I knew, John wasn't feeling well. He was losing weight. He was a big guy and he was trying to drop some of the weight. And he put himself on the Atkins diet. And one morning he was talking about his blood pressure was really dropping and he was having issues. And I said, "Dude, you lost a lot of weight. You need to go to the doctor. You need to sort that out." He called me one morning on my way in to the station and he said that he wouldn't be there because he was having some chest pains and he was on his way to the hospital. And I said, "Oh, yeah, by all means, go. I'll take care of it. We'll do the show without you." and that is that. 10:30 that morning, we got off the air at 10. Doug and I got off the air at 10. About 10:30, my phone rings, and it's John. And he says he's still in the hospital. And he says, "Well, I've got good news." And I said, "Well, what's that, John?" And he says, "I'm not having a heart attack." And I said, "Well, that's good." I said, what the hell's your problem?" He says, "I have leukemia. I have there's 7 strains of leukemia, and I have one of the most aggressive forms of it." I don't recall the actual terminology of it, but it was something that was really quite devastating when I looked it up and educated myself on it. Trust me, in the last bit of time that I spent there with working with him, I learned more about leukemia than I care to know about. And that they were going to have to admit him immediately and begin a very aggressive treatment schedule on him, and as a result he was probably going to have to be off the air. Now keep in mind, he never told Tim Spencer this at the shoot, and he said, "I need you to go have a chat with Spencer about this, and you need to tell him what I have told you." I said, "Okay." And then he said for me to call him back, and we would chat about what was going to happen with the show. Because here I was thinking that I jumped right into probably the best plum gig in the city at the time. And I had one of the fastest, funniest men in the room with me that I could breathe new life into a show and squeeze a few more years out of him before he would naturally retire. And we would have a ball doing it. And granted, some of the things that we did during that time, we had a wonderful time even while he was sick. And here's what ultimately came from this. I go to Tim Spencer and I tell him the truth. I tell him that that John has called me and has told me he's been diagnosed with leukemia, and that he was going to be in the hospital for probably at least on the outset, this was going to be inpatient treatment, so he couldn't leave the hospital because this chemotherapy that they were hitting him with was this particularly aggressive form of it. They called it the Red Devil because it in the IV bag it was like the color of cherry Kool-Aid. The nurses that would bring it in on a tray were wearing gloves that went up to their shoulders. They had a face mask on. They were wearing a hazmat suit to bring that stuff into him, and they were going to put that in him. And the doctor had told him, and which was relayed to me, that when he goes through this round of chemotherapy, which be about 6 weeks of this stuff, that he would go through what they call the Valley of Death. That's where you just shut down. You're exhausted. You're tired. You pass out. You're asleep. It's not a medically induced coma. Your body just doesn't cope with it very well. It's painful. It's shocking to your system. It is poison. It's designed to kill every living cell inside of you to stop this disease. All the while, before he got into the valley, he kept telling me he wanted to figure out a way to stay on the air, and he wanted to share the story with his audience, which I thought took an impressive amount of bravery. And I had to tell him, I said, well, you got a point there, because it's not like you got a flu for 6 weeks. I mean, we're going to have to, this is going to be a big deal. The media is going to jump all over this. This is going to be a big story. There's going to be a light shined onto us. There's going to be obviously we're going to have a lot more listeners, but we can't play it off as though we're trying to cash in on that. Which, of course, is exactly what Tim Spencer wanted to do. As that point, Tim Davies, you know, he had left around that time. Brief aside, Tim Davies left, got a job with Bruce Demps at Radio 1 in Atlanta, turned in a two-week notice and left 3 days into it. Just a bastard. So we were dealt with another cut of the cloth, a guy by the name of Michael Oppenheimer. I mention Michael now because he plays a very key part into the remainder of this story. He was the general manager who had come up from a Clear Channel cluster out of Oklahoma City. Or was it Tulsa? It may have been Tulsa. Also grew up in Austin, Texas. It was a man who admitted to everybody in the room that he had never seen a sitcom television show. Not one episode. No Friends, no MASH, no Seinfeld, no Big Bang Theory, none of that. He'd never seen it. He never had any interest in seeing any of that stuff. So first of all, we knew we were up against the ropes because he didn't understand comedy the way that we attempted to lay it out to our audience. And somehow trying to find a bit of comedy in the fact that one half of a very successful morning show was laying on his back in a hospital room going through what is going to be best described as the Valley of Death. And there's really a 50-50 shot of him even coming out of it. It was a very sobering thought. The day they started the administration of the drug to John, they had a cardiologist on staff because of the PICC line that they had inserted into his pectoral muscle, and it feeds right into the top veins that lead into the heart, the top artery right there, because there's a 30% chance or a 35% chance that the administration of that drug would cause his heart to stop. That's the cure for this particular form of leukemia. Well, John hung in there, by God. We figured out a way to set up a remote rig in his hospital room where he would wear a headset type arrangement that was headphones and a microphone that would allow him to hear what's on the air and hear me and be able to hear himself and be able to hear all the beds and stuff like that. And it would also allow me to talk to him when we were off the air. I could talk to him. It was called a back channel, a secondary channel that was not on the air. So we kept in communication as to what direction we were going with in the show, and I could listen, I could monitor him a little bit. I could tell if he was getting really tired, not to get into, you know, too many things that were heavy. And we kind of had to gauge the show that way. Now, you got to keep in mind that when you're used to working with somebody in the studio, it is almost imperative to have this nonverbal facial communication that goes on in that room. You have to know where that one person is leading, and you can tell by looking into their eyes what direction they're going usually. And when you don't have that, because all you hear is the sound on the other end of your headphones, you have to just tap into that sixth sense and just know that you've worked with him long enough to know where he's going and what direction you need to steer him, and vice versa. And we pulled it off pretty well. 18 months of it we did. It was stellar radio. Our numbers were huge. Drake and Zeke were doing mornings at XMX, and we were beating them despite what was being said by everybody else. We were beating them. We were smashing all of our records. I was in bonus territory for the last year and a half of my career there, but not one bonus check was paid because Michael Oppenheimer was a cheap bastard. Let me tell you how cheap this man was. His diagnosis came in October. It was about October 26th, 27th, something like that. Maybe the 28th. And by that Christmas, that week of Christmas, it was December 23rd, Michael Oppenheimer and Tim Spencer paid John a visit to the hospital, where they went into the room and John, barely conscious, exhausted, thought it was kind of nice that they had paid him a visit. And of course, these two corporate schlubs paid it off or played it off that way until Michael Oppenheimer reached down, knelt down kind of to John's ear and said, "Listen, we're here on business," and said that we're going to be taking a 10% pay cut out of you. Week of Christmas, going through a round of chemotherapy, barely able to speak, barely able to defend himself, and these corporate motherfuckers came in there and they did that to him. John called me that night. I could barely understand him because he couldn't get much more of a whisper out of him, and he told me what was going on, and he was angry. He was very pissed off, as I think anybody would be. And he said that had he the strength to do it, he would have strangled him from his hospital bed. And of course, Tim Spencer sitting there with nothing to add because it's what he was. He was a coward, had no balls. Not there for any type of support or anything like that. But this is what went down. Now, keep in mind, John is the father of two teenage boys. And John's ex-wife, no real story there, but was not that much of a support all the way around. And I won't get into that because that involves the McCormack family, and I refuse to go any further than that. But aside from this about the McCormack family, John came from a very large family, a lot of brothers. He had a sister. They had taken me in as their family, of which will become abundantly clear here shortly. So back to the hospital. John goes through this chemo. He survives all of this. He did manage to tell Oppenheimer that if one penny was taken from his pay, that he would sue them back to the Stone Age, and that stopped it. Stopped it immediately, especially since John's attorney got involved and threatened everybody over 3 feet tall that was anywhere near that damn hospital or in Memphis with a lawsuit regarding the man's pay. He was sick. He was dying. John goes into remission, miraculously, and comes back. And his whole idea was, you know what? Fuck these bastards. If they're going to get us, they're going to get us while I'm healthy and while I'm on our 2 feet, because we have to fight for everything that we have to fight for at this point. We have brought them a number one show. We are making them more money than they know what to do with. Our show, we calculated, was probably worth about $4.5 million a week. That was the income that radio station was making off of my back and off of Bad Dog's back. It was enormous. So John's doing well. He has to wear the mask every once in a while. He had a few checkups. There was a few months there where things were going pretty well, and looked like things were getting back on track. And Tim Spencer, being the micromanaging fuck that he was, decided that the new trend in talk radio and morning drive radio was this little stunt called astroturfing. And that's what we ultimately called it, but it was something to that effect. Here's how it works. When you listen to a show like Rush Limbaugh, who has a lot of people that call into his show, those people are actors that are down a hallway and they're given a script or a flat line to read onto the air. And this is done because if anybody were to disagree with Rush, they wouldn't be listening to a show in the first place. So they've got to have somebody to call in and do that. So all that shit's fake. Well, that's what they wanted to do with John and I, because we did take a lot of calls. And we got into some pretty heavy topics. And the way I got around the whole agreement or disagreement was by dividing the audience. And by a lot of standards, broadcasters are told, don't polarize your audience. I do it all the time. I still do it because I believe in that. I believe that's how people think. They don't have to like what I have to say, but they can respect it. Or they can like what I have to say, but have a differing opinion on certain outcomes of that. A lot of times John would make a remark, even if I agreed with it, I would disagree with it just to create a little conflict on the air. Sometimes to my own amusement, because I knew what buttons to push to get John really riled up. Tim Spencer thought he had it right until John threw a coffee cup at him. And there was also that time that Tim nearly got thrown out of the plate glass window, but, you know, we can dream. Nevertheless, they were going to force that into us, and we said no. We weren't going to do that. Corporate brought in a consultant. These are probably the most evil form of person that works in this business. These are people who don't know what broadcasting is. They've never cracked a mic. They've never been in a pressure situation. They've never had to deliver in an ad lib type of environment and try and maintain an audience, especially when your partner's been sick. So they tried to define these roles for us. John would be this person. I would be that person. Who was the funny guy? Who was the straight guy? Well, between John and I, those lines were blurred. We each set each other up. We each had our own punchlines. We used to, John would land a punchline and I'd come right behind him with a second punchline or a callback and a way that the way it would go. And it was big. And I was then dubbed the loose cannon. Corporate didn't like that. And Spencer sitting in this meeting with John and I and this moron, this consultant, I never did catch his name because he lost my credibility with him when he said he'd never been on the air. And John at that point stood up and said, "This is bullshit. We're done with it. It's done. It's over with. That's that. We're going to do what we do. We've brought the numbers. We're continuing to keep the numbers and things are going to go well. So back off, back the fuck off and let us do our job." That's what it boiled down to. And to Spencer's credit, he did. Right up until till John's checkup and the leukemia had come back. And it was time to go through more chemotherapy, which meant more remote type of shows. Corporate wanted to take him off the air. John said, "No, you take me off the air. That's it for me." And that they would fire Rick is what he said. Because he told me that. And he stayed on, not just for my benefit, but he stayed on for himself. He needed to do it. As he said, "What the hell else am I going to do at 6 o'clock in the morning? It's not like I'm sleeping very well in the most expensive fucking hotel in the city of Memphis," which was the hospital he was in. At one point, there was actually quite a funny incident where they were getting him up and around. He wasn't on as heavy a chemo this second go around, and he was able to kind of get up and walk around. In fact, they encouraged it a little bit, and he was kind of on this sort of a strange restricted diet, and he was bitching about the food, because if you've ever been in the hospital, they bring the food to you and it's got that dish over the top of it, the cover the plate deal thing, and they bring it in there and they pull the lid off of that thing, and the room immediately smells of, it's the concentrated dinner or lunch just smelling up the whole room. And so it wasn't that it was horrible, it's just that when it invades your sense of smell that way, it becomes, you know, a bit off-putting. He snuck out of the hospital. This is John. This is classic John, wearing his gown with his ass hanging out, and he had his IV thing, which had of course the saline and one of the chemo things and maybe some vitamins, and he had the mask on, and he had a $20 bill in his hand, and he had some slippers on, and he slipped out of the hospital, and he crossed a major thoroughfare to a Subway to get a damn sandwich. Which must have been amusing to the people that were behind the counter, because this guy really, really wanted his sandwich. They wouldn't give John any salt, which is another incident. They said that it was detrimental to his health. And he said, "Fuck you. I've lost my hair. I've lost the ability to use the bathroom on my own. I can't eat anything else. You're going to give me salt or I'm going to kick your ass." So there were times when Brother Doug would sneak up there and take him packets of salt, like you get it, you know, like at a fast food joint. And he said that that was like prison money, and that he would go around to the various rooms in his ward, and he would pass these little packets of salt out to these people, and they would laugh immensely because they all knew who John was. I mean, he was a big celebrity. He was huge. He was an A-list celebrity in this town. Knowing full well that the battle that he was engaged in right now could very well end in the loss of his life, and he had come to grips with it. He wasn't a very deeply spiritual person, but he became rather religious there toward the end, and that's John. I guess a lot of people would have that as well. He came to grips with his own mortality, and we had long talks about that on the phone at night before I would go on the air, and we became very close. He wasn't just a coworker. He wasn't just my sidekick on the air. He was my brother. He was my family. And we had something really cool. on the air and off the air. We were very close like that. And a lot of times our conversation would always turn to the business at hand, which was dealing with these monsters at Clear Channel. And I use that term monster in the literal sense because they are truly monsters. They didn't want John to go back on the air. John fought for it. I fought for it. We kept him on. I need to back up a little bit because at the point when John was unconscious for about 6 weeks during that, when he was in the Valley of Death, we had guest hosts that would come in. Let me tell you something. I'll never do that again. I worked with some people that did not have any business anywhere near a microphone. Good God Almighty. My patience was tested to the absolute limits to the point that I ran everybody out of there. I didn't even want to do the show anymore until John was ready. So I muscled through it. I put up with it as best I could. John comes back. Everything's back on track. And all right. So, you know, we're back in the hospital again. John's doing the show remote again. And at this point, we're starting to gather the attention of the local newspaper who wants to do a story on this. Now, keep in mind, Michael Oppenheimer didn't want any media coverage of any of this. This doesn't add up on the surface, but there's a real reason why that happened, because they didn't want any more light shed on the situation at hand. They didn't want too much public support, and here's why. The grand plan, had John not gotten sick, was that John and I both would have been let go. The show would have been turned over to a syndicator, but we beat the odds. We gave them more numbers they knew what to do with. They were making more money than they knew what to handle with off of that, but they couldn't get rid of us because John was sick, and you can't fire a guy on his deathbed. I don't care how cold-hearted you are. There are laws against this sort of thing. John comes out of this last round of chemo, and he is back into remission. Things are well. Looks like he's got a handle on it. Looks like he's going to beat it. Just in time for the Ronald McDonald House Radiothon. It was the 20th one. It was my 15th, 14th. It would be my last. It would be the last one that Rock 103 would ever do. We would stay on the air for 28 hours. John was sick, but he managed to pull it off in the studio. Had to wear a mask a good number of times, but was able to pull it off. And during downtimes during the radiothon, he and I would chat when no one was around. And there was this ever-present rumor that was going around. Now, what I'm about to tell you should anger you. And what I'm about to tell you should really make you kind of sick, if you're not sickened by this already. The radiothon would every year would average $600,000-$700,000 that we would give to the Ronald McDonald House, which of course is a home for parents and children that are seeking treatment at St. Jude. It's a cancer thing. And John was very close to that charity anyway. He'd been so for many, many years and loved those children deeply. And him actually going through this disease with them said he would say oftentimes that this would put him in the ability to walk the same path that those children, those brave children, had done all those many a year. Some would survive, many didn't. John was now one of them and was in that fight. And when word got out that Clear Channel was going to take 10% off the top of the donations from all of our listeners during this radiothon to pocket for themselves. Yeah, that's what I said. 10% of all the donations would go to Clear Channel. It was never substantiated, but it was a very strong rumor, and nobody really denied it. John and I discussed openly about the fact that this would probably be our last radiothon together because he wouldn't take part in that. If he wants to give to that house, he would do it on his own without some type of a corporate mandate that we do things their way. It made me angry, but it also got me through the last 12 hours of that broadcast. Even after that particular show, when I got home, I knew that my days with John were even more numbered. Because some of the most painful things that I ever went through were just beginning. John had relapsed a third time. The only hope for him now was a bone marrow transplant. Now, fortunately for John, he's got an enormous family, and there was someone in his family that matched him genetically. And they went through the whole process. And from my understanding of the way bone marrow transplants work and the way it was explained to me by John was that you didn't have to have 100% match. But basically what they do is they kill you. They literally kill you. They destroy your immune system, and they take that away from you, and then they rebuild it with this new bone marrow that they put into you. It's like a clear liquid. It looks like plasma, I guess it would be, like a watery type of stuff. And then your body takes that and it rebuilds an immune system. What's really bizarre about this sort of thing, just as a point of science, it actually changes your DNA to the point that you're not the same person. It's really quite remarkable. But you don't have to have 100% takeover. You just have to have enough for the body, the antibodies inside the donor DNA to take over and really begin to multiply on their own. And then the body becomes self-sufficient. It kicks out the old leukemia cells. It kills all of that. You're off and running. You're ready to go. So they put him back into remission. They hit him with the new bone marrow, and things are going really well. He had a 30% take with his bone marrow. That's remarkable. At least I'm told. It was great. John had a very good shot of beating this. In fact, we weren't even counting our chickens, but by saying it looks like I've got this beat came out of his face. And he said, thank God, because there's really only one thing I'm really living for right now, and that's for me to see my boys get through high school and get into college and have a life without me having to hold their hands any further. February 24th, 2011. John and I did our show together. John was in the hospital wrapping up his bone marrow stuff. He was about to be released within the next week. It was a Friday. 10:20 a.m., the door kicks open. It's Tim Spencer and Eric Lewis. Eric Lewis is the human resources guy. I knew it. It was coming. And you know how I knew it was coming? This was the end of my career. That show that I had just done with John was my last one. My career at Clear Channel was over. This is how I knew it. The ineptitude of Tim Spencer was so staggering that he accidentally copied Brother Doug on an email outlining the plans of destroying the morning show and replacing it with a free syndicated show out of Wisconsin by two guys that knew nothing about the Memphis market. John was going to be working back with Tim in the afternoons again, and they were going to get this show for free. They couldn't fire John because, well, he was sick. But they were trying to remove everybody over the age of 35 that was drawing a salary. They still do that in this business. I had a heads up. My thanks to Brother Doug for telling me that. I kept that under my hat all these years because I didn't want to get him in trouble. So Tim and Eric come into the studio, and my headphones, oddly enough, the ones that I wore that day are actually on my head right now. I had them around my neck, and I was getting ready to do some production work. And Tim comes in, and now he's wearing glasses all of a sudden. Like, that makes him some type of a more important person because you're wearing glasses. Which I'm glad he was, so he could not only hear what I had to say, but read my lips very clearly. He said, I'm sorry. We're making some changes, and you're the odd man out. It's the same fucking line he gave Dennis. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, it's just not working. I said, what do you mean it's not working? Numbers are good. Numbers are not good, he said. A little background on how numbers are calculated. It's broken down into age demographics, 18 to 34 years of age and 25 and 54 years of age. According to my contract, my target demo was male 25-54. If we had those numbers solid in the number one slot or by a certain margin, we had earned our keep, in essence. We earned our bonuses. And it's broadcasting with a gun held to your head is what it really boils down to. And I didn't really come to grips with it until I had gotten away from it. But Tim sat there, and with a straight face, and flat out lied and said, your numbers are no good. You're not number one. We've got to make these changes. And we're going with the syndicated show out of Wisconsin. And I was dumbfounded because I couldn't, they wouldn't ever tell us the numbers. I had to go through another radio personality in this city who will remain nameless to another broadcasting corporation that will remain nameless. Not that it should matter because he was fired shortly after I was, just for similar things, stupid shit. But because I respect him, I won't do that. We were told we weren't funny. The comedy was gone. The humor was no longer in the show. And I've got to let you go. Now, keep in mind, this is coming from a man who I bailed out of every scenario he got himself into. He would forget to put in the log into the computer to update the music. I did that. I was the guy that had to call him at 5:30 in the morning to tell him that there was a problem that he needed to be aware of. And he would say, fix it. There were times I was on my hands and knees underneath that goddamn control board with a Swiss Army knife trying to keep the fucker on the air because the engineers weren't around. They had wired themselves out of a job. They weren't going to be in until 8:00 in the morning. Thanks. It's 6:00. I got a guy in Kansas City who is calling me saying, hey, you're off the air. Well, no shit, fucker. What are you going to do? Get in your truck and drive down here and fix it? I come out from under the board one time and Michael Oppenheimer is standing there and I see his feet and his, you know, his expensive fucking Bruno Mali shoes and his pants. And I stand up there and I look at him. I'm sweating. I'm covered in dirt and grease. You think you can get it back out on the air? And I looked at him dead in the face. I said, I'm not even supposed to be here right now. I'm not an engineer. Oppenheimer didn't even have the balls to fire me myself or himself. So, you know, that really spoke volumes. And, you know, Tim is trying to tell me that it just wasn't going to work anymore and that I'm sorry, but it's done. It's over with. I know it's tough firing people. I've done it. It's not easy. Breaks my heart when I have to do it. But there was no heartbreak out of this motherfucker at all. He was glad to see me go. And he started to look down at his feet as I'm letting this sink in and I pull my headphones off around my neck and I pick up my bag and I start packing my things. And Eric finally pipes up. John and I used to call him Eric the Red. He was a big guy. He was an accountant. He had shocking red hair and we used to call him Eric the Red. And Eric says, but I've got good news. Without him saying another word, and without missing a beat, I looked at him and Spencer and I said, you just saved a bunch on your car insurance, didn't you? As the old line goes, I've got good news. I've just saved a bunch of money on my car insurance. Tim laughed. Eric laughed. I didn't. I looked at Tim dead square in the eye and I said, not fucking funny, huh? Tim apologized again, as best as he possibly could. For a soulless fuck that he is. And I asked him, I said, outside of this studio, is there a security guard out there? Because that was the norm. When somebody was let go, they would bring in security guards to walk you to your car. As if being fired wasn't demeaning enough, they would make sure that you left under armed security as though you're going to somehow magically set the place on fire. And Tim said, no, he wasn't going to do that to me. I said, good, because if they were out here, they would be pulling me off of you and putting you into an ambulance. He walked me to the back door of the place, which classy move, took my key. And I stopped and I looked at him and I said, can I at least get a reference from you? And he said, I cannot in good conscience do that. I shook his hand. I said, I hope you get everything that you want. I hope you are able to succeed. And I hope that you are able to do the things that you've always wanted to do. I got into the elevator. There was a coworker that was just coming off and he said, Hey Rick, how's it going? You done for the day? And I went, I'm done for my career. He thought I was joking. Doors closed. I went on to my car. The obligatory phone calls were made. I get home. I'm trying to soak all this in. And my phone rings and it's Drake Hall from the Drake and Zeke show. And he tells me that he had heard the news, because news travels fast. It's funny. In the radio business, communication is the worst thing that goes on. But when shit like this happens, everybody knows about it. So he calls me and he tells me the following things. It's okay, Rick. It's not your fault. Nobody properly taught you how to be on the air. He said, there's no room for you here. Now, you had your chance, and the best thing that you can do is leave. Leave Memphis, leave it all behind you, and go find something else to do. And he said, it must have been hell doing a radio show with a dead man on your back. That's what I got. 14 years at Clear Channel. A good chunk of my life, good chunk of my brain power, a good chunk of my sense of humor and action and thought and concern to be dismissed like that. Of course, I talked to John that night. He was furious. He was furious over the fact that they had let me go first and foremost, but he was really upset because now he was going to have to work with Tim in the afternoons. And he would let me know how it went. Along the way, I made a few phone calls trying to find a way to land on my feet. I had a 6-month non-compete I had to work out. And one of the many gifts that came out of all of that was I got hooked up with my agent, great entertainment lawyer by the name of Charlie Hodum. I highly recommend him if you're interested in this aspect of this fucked up world. He was able to shorten my non-compete a little bit, and I actually got a couple of extra bucks out of the deal so I could survive. And John had to come out of the hospital now after, in essence, beating leukemia and go to work with Tim in the afternoons. And this went on for about a week, I suppose. And John and I were speaking on the phone one night, and it would later be his last words to me. He said that Tim had asked him personally what he thought of all the decisions that had been made at 103. And John told me that he looked him in the eye, and of course this was off the air. It was in the control room, but it was off the air. And he said, I will tell you this. You fucked it up good. You killed the radio station. You killed 103. And I will never, ever be your friend like that. I will work as best as I possibly can, but I will not be pushed any further. You ask me to be on the air with you, I'll do it. I'll laugh at your stupid jokes. I'll do what I have to do. I'll phone it in until I'm over this and then I'm out of the business. That was his plan. He was going to get out of it. He was going back to Texas, apparently, and getting back into investment banking. He'd had enough of show business. I would think after all of that, how anybody would stay in it is beyond me, but I'm one of those people. I've stayed in it for why, I don't know. Sometimes I question that. About 3 days later, I'm in my office here at the house where I am right now, and my friend Tom Dees calls me from Fox 13. Tom and I have been friends back in the WTVA days. You heard about him in the part one of this series. He said, Rick, I just got word that John's in the hospital. He was carried from his home unresponsive and that he's in a coma. You need to get down there. So I did. I got up out of my chair. I put my shoes on. Tim calls me. Spencer calls me. Perfect timing. He says, hey, how you doing? So what kind of fucking question is that? You fired me last week, you bastard. What do you want? So I want to let you know that John's in the hospital and he may not survive the night. I said, yeah, I already know. I'm headed there now. So I got in the car and I went there. He was up in the ICU. His enormous family was there. John's family. I was the only person from Clear Channel there at that moment in time, even considering I was at that point an ex-employee. I was embraced by the family. I was embraced by his two sons. They took me to his room where John was laying there, the result of having undergone surgery to take an aneurysm or clean up an aneurysm that occurred in his up in his head. He laid there with this bit of this, I don't know, piping, hosing, whatever you want to call it, that was connected to a stent in his head, and it was draining this fluid off of his brain. Had him on a machine. He couldn't breathe on his own. He looked horrible. Of course he did, after what he had gone through. And I was there for a moment. The two boys left the room. I was in there with them by myself. I grabbed his arm, and I said, wake the fuck up. Just give me one more chance to beat these bastards. And failing that, be there for your own kids. And then I said, it would really piss off Tim Spencer if you did. And he took this gigantic breath. It scared the crap out of me, quite honest with you. So I sat there in silence with him and just listening to those machines live for him, which is a very distressing sound. It's not right. It's not natural. And all of a sudden, these people started coming into the room, and it was his family. And this Episcopalian priest came in, and I couldn't get out. I was trapped. I was standing next to John, his head immediately to my right, about where my hip would be. And my back was against the wall, and there's all these people in this room. And this priest administers the last rites. And there was a bit of prayer, and then this doctor, young fellow, came in there. Obviously, a very smart man. You could tell just by looking at the guy; he was smarter than anybody else in the room combined. And he had two or three other guys with him. And he said, "Listen, we have to do an assessment on him right now, and we need you to all leave and go to the private waiting area, and we will be back in there momentarily." So we all leave. I'm the last one to leave the room. I look over my shoulder and I see these four doctors as they stand around him and they pull the door shut. I went into the private area, not really knowing. I just was talking to his family down the hallway. And all of a sudden I found myself in the middle of the family and it's like most desperate private moment. This had nothing to do with radio. This had nothing to do with anybody's career, whether mine was over or not. It was the fact that a man, somewhat of a patriarch of their family, was dying. The doctors came in and said that it was time to let him go. He was unresponsive. There was no brain activity. And that it was over. Somebody in the family had asked if it was the leukemia that got him, and they said, no, it wasn't. It looks like it was the aneurysm that finally did it in. Later, I would find that he had been in his kitchen making a sandwich for himself and had worked himself up into so much anger over what had happened to his beloved radio station and his show that the aneurysm snapped and he collapsed and, in essence, was dead before he hit the floor. I carried that. I carried that for 3 years. Over 3 years. And right now is where I drop it off. He had a public memorial service at Hope Presbyterian Church, the big mega church out east. And there was a nice crowd there. I didn't want to go, actually. But of all people, Diana talked me into it. Diana was... I'd come to know her through another coworker there at the radio station, and she said, "You'd be a fool not to go. You were the what kind of kept him going." But what I had to carry around was that my fear was that it was my termination. And the death of that radio station is what ultimately snapped in his head. And that's tough to carry. It wasn't my fault. I know that. That's a lot of pain. Which is why I'm sitting here now telling you this. So I can get it out and drop this load that I've been carrying around for these 3 years. After the service, the public service, I had been reminded of a line that John told me before he died. He said that, should I die, Rick, I need you to do me a favor. I need you to make me a promise, and you make sure that Tim Spencer and Michael Oppenheimer do not attend my funeral. I failed at that. although I saw both of them in the vestibule or the entry, the I know the cause, whatever. It's a mega church, for God's sake. The Rolling Stones couldn't fill the room. It in the entryway. And boy, howdy, I nearly grabbed one of them by the throat and punched the other one in the face. And like I said, I'm not even violent, but it was just, I understand why people have these tendencies. I let it go. If it's any consolation, they didn't show up at the graveside ceremony. So I guess in a way I'm off the hook. So I'm standing there at the graveyard ceremony, and the pastor of Hope Presbyterian, Craig Strickland, who came to me and said, I just had learned 2 minutes before I went on stage of what they had done to you before John's death. Hope Presbyterian was a big advertiser for Rock 103. They pulled every penny out of it when they'd heard that story of what had happened. They promised that no matter where I went and whatever I did, they would be there to support me. Well, that didn't happen. So, you know, I'm probably for the better for it. There were people that were at that graveside ceremony who had my back, or so they claimed, and felt sorry for me, and I didn't want that pity. I appreciated it, of course, you know, because I was hurt. I was there to bury a friend. And as it turned out, my terrestrial career. And it just needs to be noted that of all of the things that I went through in my 30 years in my career, for it to end like that would be the most tragic thing to ever happen to me that I could think of. Long story short, Radio Memphis was born out of the ashes, out of the flames, out of the destruction, out of having been told to leave, after having been told that I wasn't funny. And I apologize to you people that are tuning in looking for humor, because it's not happening here in this one. It's just not going to happen. It's too tough for me to even cross that line at this moment. But what I can tell you is that I know basic truths that I have held to myself as a broadcaster, and that was never to lie to my audience. This is the story from my perspective. Most of it is stuff you've never heard before, and this will be the only time I will ever speak of it in public. It's difficult for me to walk down those hallways anymore, so I won't. Not after this. And now, as Paul Harvey used to say, you know the rest of the story.
Here's what's coming up on the next edition from Radioland.
That's disgusting.
But that's the business. You give people what they've never seen or heard before, and then that shit happens.
That's absolutely disgusting.
Right.
Dirty Diana is in here. Dirty D, Diana Fryer, the general manager of Radio Memphis.
The coolest thing for me on what we do here, it's, and you've said this before, you know, it's not like we're reinventing the wheel, okay?
No.
Radio, true radio, has a purpose.
Look, about half the time that we've been on the phone with each other, I've been in the bathroom, too.
You know what? And
you know, sitting on the can, you know, I'm going through my phone, you know, checking email, looking at Facebook, you know.
Journey, only journey, 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 and then we're going to hear a little bit of Tom Petty. Journey, 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 journey. No, we're not going to do that.
Just describe my nightmare.
Radio Memphis is an internet broadcasting service provided by PirateRadioStudios.com, Memphis, Tennessee, USA.
So on that, that's going to do it for this episode. Of course, this is not the end of the podcast. We'll continue on next week. We'll have more things, as you've just heard in the tease there. And once again, I thank you also very much for your patience, your kindness, your understanding, and your support. It means more to me than you'll ever know. I don't know what else to do but to sit here and run my mouth about certain things, and I will do my best from here on out to amuse you, to entertain you, to put all the old stuff to bed and start new chapters, of which we've been doing very successfully at Radio Memphis. And for the past 3 years, we have grown from a couple of punk records getting played in the back bedroom of a house to something that is so much larger than that and so much more than anything could ever ask for. And it was more dreams than I could ever hope to have accomplished. 130 countries, 300,000 people a day listen to this radio station. And I couldn't have done it without all of you. And to the 37,000, 40,000 subscribers to this podcast, I thank you as well. And thank you for being so close to it all. And there you have it, kids. That's another edition from Radioland. My name is Rick Cheddar. Thank you. And we'll see you next time.